Kia ora, welcome to IOU, the University of Otago Alumni Podcast Series, where we get to talk to some of our extraordinary graduates about their out-of-the-ordinary day jobs. This week, we're very excited to welcome visualisation scientist and Otago PhD graduate Kimberly Arcand. Kim has quite an out-of-this-world role as a science communicator for NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory, which has its headquarters at the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Kim uses data to tell stories about astronomy, physics, molecular biology, and computer science. She's a pioneer in astronomy data visualization, 3D printing, and virtual reality. So welcome, Kim. It's wonderful to have you on our podcast.
Thanks. It's really nice to be here with you.
And this is quite the CV. I must say, I do feel a little bit intimidated interviewing a science communicator who works for NASA.
Oh my gosh, not at all. It's been a long, slow, sort of circuitous journey. So I'm excited to kind of talk about some of my experiences with you.
Oh, that's great. Thank you. I guess first, can you tell us what the Chandra X-ray is and what your role is there with NASA?
Yeah, so the Chandra X Observatory is one of NASA's great observatories. You can kind of liken it to the Hubble Space Telescope or to the James Webb Space Telescope, except Chandra is looking at a type of light, X-ray light, that human eyes, human vision can't detect. And so it's all about finding these really extreme energetic places in the universe, things like exploding stars, black holes, colliding galaxies, so much more. And it's really exciting because it's a wonderful collaboration between NASA and between the Smithsonian, just absolutely filled with creative scientists and engineers and technologists and administrators that work together to do what I think is a pretty incredible job of discovering new things about our high energy universe, helping fit in some of those pieces of the puzzle, and then figuring out ways to, you know, work with that data with other people, with other scientists, with other non-experts and the like.
So what exactly is your role, Kim? What do you do there?
Well, I've categorized myself as a data storyteller because I find it hard to put myself in any particular box. I'm a bit of a data and science nerd at heart. I have a background in computer coding, so I'm just kind of all into that techie geekery. But I also really love people, and I'm fascinated with how people perceive data and understand how it's represented and learn from that data, whether as a scientist or as a novice or anywhere in between. So I consider myself a data storyteller because I feel like that groups things together and lets me be as creative as I need to be.
And is this something you were always interested in? Is this a childhood thing, this interest in space and data and telling stories?
Yes to all of the above. I always loved science. I love the idea of science and what it could offer, like figuring out puzzles and getting to learn things and understand things about the world around us. And I could never really decide on one type of science, to be honest. I loved many different kinds of science. I love nature and different kinds of animals and plants, and I just wanted to learn it all. So landing in space, not literally, but to tell stories, was a really fun place to be because I get to think mostly about the universe. But when it comes to things like considering exoplanets or planets outside of our solar system, some of my old biology background kicks into gear because you have to understand, for example, what might a habitable planet look like, how life might be able to grow elsewhere, and all sorts of puzzles like that.
So how did you end up at this role in NASA from school and your initial university degree?
Well, my initial degree was in molecular biology, but I had realized I didn't really want to study under a microscope for the rest of my career. And so the last almost 2 years of my undergraduate work, I had learned a lot of coding. I just kind of got adopted by the computer science department and they were fantastic. This is at the University of Rhode Island, and they really helped me see that I could learn what I needed to learn and become a coder and a developer and all of that. And that started me on a path of having the combination of science skills and computer science skills, which I didn't know at the time, but a lot of different sciences, particularly astronomy, runs on coding. So coding is like the backbone for all of the work that's done. Once you have data, essentially, you have to, of course, assemble a spacecraft that's going to go up into space. But once that spacecraft is up there, you're communicating with it just by coding. And then you're processing the data that's transmitted back to you by more coding via software that people have written. And then you're processing it out again with more software and more coding that you or somebody else has written. And I didn't realize how closely sciences like astronomy are related to computer science and how very intricately woven that those two happen to be. So I found myself at the right place at the right time with the right skill set. And this is going back to 1998. So it's been quite a few years. And my job has just evolved over time. Like stars evolve over time. My job has evolved over time. And my interests have evolved likewise. And I always found that more education was, for me, exciting to kind of fill in those knowledge gaps.
So you went to this role straight from university or similar role. And then after a while, you came down to New Zealand, to Otago. How did that happen? That's kind of, we'd love to know how you ended up in Otago.
It's a people story. I think like many stories tend to be. When I was working for Chandra, and I still am, but at back in the late, I want to say 2008, maybe, I started working with two researchers, Lisa and Jeffrey Smith, and I knew of them or learned of them because their nephew, Randall Smith, worked with me. And we were interested, we were having these discussions, Randall and I, about how we desperately needed to learn more about how people perceive data of the universe, because these data that are captured, they are of things that humans can't naturally see. And we process them into a visual representation of the object. But it's not a space selfie, right? It is not a photograph. It is a translation, like you translate English to Mandarin. It is a process of translation. And there are people doing those translations. So it's not this cold, sterile world that you might imagine, right? And so in conversations with him, he's like, well, you know, I know a couple people that are into image and meaning and this idea of perception studies. And Lisa and Jeff were brought into my world and I've kind of never let them go. I jokingly called to Lisa as my space auntie and Jeff as my space uncle. They're brilliant people who, I think I'm very attracted to people who think in different ways and are a little bit out of the box. And they're very interdisciplinary and very creative people. And I love that. And they have all the intellectual rigor, of course, in their work. And they are now retired, but they just recently retired as professors from the University of Otago. And yeah, once I find people that I like, I tend to latch onto them like a barnacle. And so they were stuck with me for a while. And Lisa was the one that encouraged me to apply for a PhD because I don't know. She thought, well, she knew I'm a bit of a nerd and I would love to learn more. And it seemed the right time. My kids were a bit older, so I thought it'd be a little bit easier to do. And she was a fantastic, fantastic PhD advisor to work with. I worked with her and another woman and the two of them. It was just, you know, when some people come into your lives and they just kind of get what you're trying to do, it's not always, I don't know, easy to find that, but Lisa and Karen Pratt, both of them really got the way my brain worked and kind of what I was thinking to do. And they were fantastic women to have kind of on my team as I was navigating another path of education towards a PhD.
What was your PhD topic? Can you just describe? Possibly it's quite complex, but you probably have a way that you can describe it for us.
Yeah. So it's kind of an amalgamation of a social science, a computer science, and a little bit of, it's like if you're creating a recipe, right? You're going to take a big bowl, you're going to throw in a good dash of astronomy, you're going to throw in a good dash of the computer science and technology, a really large chunk of social science, and definitely a hefty amount of statistics. So the idea was to kind of understand how three-dimensional models of astrophysical data, we create three-dimensional models as a way to understand these objects in their reality, if you will, These are not two-dimensional, you know, TV screens that we're gazing at. These are dynamic, ever-changing, and very shape-based objects. And so we use combinations of observational data and mathematical data to create 3D models. Those are typically created for science as a way to understand them, but those models themselves can also teach us more, and they can help other people understand that objects in our sky are dynamic and shaped in different ways and ever-changing. And so the idea was kind of to see and to understand how these three-dimensional models, particularly in an extended reality space of these astrophysics concepts, things like exploding stars, can affect different kinds of people, can affect people's learning skills or spatial skills, if you will, and what that impact might be from the expert to the non-expert spectrum. So it sounds complicated, but if I'm going to boil it down to a simpler explanation, as I should, it's just about how we can take 3D models of our universe and figure out how people learn from them. That's really it in a nutshell.
You do quite a lot. I mean, you kind of communicate across the spectrum. You do quite a lot of communication for children, science communication. And you've got some great books, and Alien helped me with my homework and things like that. So how do you take something like that and explain that visually to children?
It's just a different kind of storytelling. You know, I have two kids and I spent a lot of time weaving stories for them on long car rides. And that was kind of my litmus test for a successful story. If it kept two young, active children kind of ill in the back seat of the car, that I knew, all right, this one might be okay. And so one of the children's books I wrote was just a parody of Goodnight Exomoon. It was such a favorite story of mine. It's a lovely tale. But I was, you know, reading it over and over to my kids one day and in a long car ride and getting bored of it myself, because I think I might have read it like 5 times. And I just started riffing off of it, like, okay, what if it was, instead of, you know, a normal moon, what if it was an exomoon, a moon outside our solar system? Because there were theories that, of course, if there are planets outside of our solar system, that based on our own experiences in our solar system, there would likely be moons and comets as well in these other planetary systems. And so exomoons and exocomets. And I just kind of played with the words a little bit and thought it was kind of fun and clever myself, you know, as dorky parents will do. But my kids kind of got a chuckle out of it, and they were very young. And I'm like, well, this is fun. So I wrote it down and kind of put it in a drawer and never really thought of it again. And then when my kids grew up a little older, it actually turned out that there was a preliminary sort of finding of an exomoon, and it hasn't been confirmed yet. But even to see that first scientific paper come out of a moon outside of our solar system was incredible, because when you think of how challenging it is just to find another planet outside of our solar system, it's a bit of a needle in a haystack. And scientists have found like well over 5,000 of these, and candidate systems too, of course. But to be able to find more and to find even smaller object like exomoons was really exciting. And so it kind of just evolved. I'm like, well, maybe this could actually be a book, because the science is starting to come alive. And, you know, it led to something that we published. But I think really when all is said and done, it's just understanding your audience and trying to relate to that information through their eyes, right? And I think that's one of the beautiful things when you're doing a PhD. It really does give you a sense, many different audiences that you're working with, it gives you a sense for how best to see things through their eyes, to walk in their shoes, however you want to phrase it. And that kind of a learning tool is very powerful for no matter what you might do. Being able to understand someone else is, I think, a really important skill, and just, I don't know, a really good thing to have as a human in your back pocket as you're wandering through the streets of life, so to speak.
So just back to Otago, and you mentioned your PhD again there. Were there other highlights of your time while you were doing your PhD?
Well, I learned a lot of statistics. That was a highlight. And I think just getting to work so closely with my PhD advisors was really the best highlight. Like, I'll just never forget those types of working relationships and how flexible they were, because I am a working mom and, you know, I am an author and all that. And I don't know, just being able to work with people who not only understood you, but also really respected what you were trying to do, and that you are a living human creature. You know, there was no intense pressure. If I was having an issue, I knew I could bring it to them. And both Lisa and Karen would just be very responsive and supportive. So I think I had heard so many stories of other people having challenges through their PhD program and found this experience at Otago to be so completely different than what I had expected in the best way, because I had a support structure there, which I was hoping for, because I had known Lisa already, of course, pretty well. But I didn't know the system at Otago. I didn't know Karen very well, and I didn't know how it would work in actuality. So to be able to have navigated through that without feeling like I was divorcing my family and, you know, leaving an existing career behind and all that was pretty fantastic for me. It's definitely something I'll never forget.
And have you been able to carry your 3D work that you did with your PhD? Is that carrying on? You're developing that further?
Yes, actually all the time. So one of the great things about astronomy is as new telescopes come online and as we get additional data from our existing telescopes, we just build up a richer and richer treasure chest of information. And that treasure chest now is just loaded with gold. And part of the fun and joy of working in astronomy is that it's a pretty deep chest that you have to sift through and figure out, all right, which of these little nuggets of gold is going to turn into the best data process and product. And so we've gotten to create different kinds of 3D models with our colleagues that are just fantastic. And that will only speed up, right? It's not going to slow down anytime soon. So the models are still being worked on for science. And that means we'll forever have additional content to be able to work with different audiences. And one of the audiences I found most rewarding with the 3D modeling has been audiences who are either blind or low vision, because for them, being able to explore a data set tactilely through a 3D print of that model is something that can be very, very rewarding, because it offers a more in-depth and involved, personalized experience than they might be able to get through just a description of an object. Now, of course, descriptions of objects are also very worthy, as are data sonifications of objects. And my team works on all of those different kinds of modalities of producing data and understanding data. And the reason is we know that that serves many different audiences. And we've heard anecdotally, and I hope to do additional research on this, that that type of product, particularly for people who are blind or low vision, helps them self-identify more as someone who could, if not be a scientist, be a part of the scientific enterprise, or if they didn't want to do that, at least be a member of society that is being able to learn what new science is coming out, right? Like that those are all possibilities now, whereas before it didn't feel as much of a possibility if they felt they were being excluded from the scientific enterprise completely. So once a sonification, a 3D print or a visual description is available to a community and they feel like they are being more included in that enterprise of knowledge absorption and production and awareness, then they now feel, as has been told to me, that it's a possibility that they could be a scientist or, again, a citizen scientist or just a fan, whatever, like whatever the interest level might be. And that to me is incredibly exciting. The fact that a model that we've worked on to help understand a scientific concept can then be brought into extended reality for one audience member to understand scale better, to then be 3D printed so that somebody who is blind or low vision could better explore that data, or that could then be sonified and turned into sound so that somebody who is neurodivergent could process that data in a different way, or somebody who's blind or low vision can participate in that. Like all of those different threads and fingers, if you will, of that data process are all valid, exciting, and also very researchable, which is rewarding.
Yeah, I was going to say that must be all really rewarding to feel like you're pushing at some boundaries there, opening things up for people that access has been closed off before. I suppose as a communicator, that's, you know, central to your job.
It's hugely rewarding, right? Because I like to, though I spend parts of my days buried in the ones and the zeros, the data and the science geekery side and the techie geekery side, at the end of the day, I really like people and I want to understand how people are understanding that data and perceiving that data, learning from that data, experiencing that data, what have you. And so to know that my team has helped push any of those boundaries and help people feel more welcome in a community that can feel off-putting, that can feel like it's up in a tower, is incredibly exciting to me. So yeah, it has been a journey. It has been a stellar journey, I guess, you know, out there with the data of the stars, but it's been a very personal journey as well to be able to just think a bit differently about our data and how we're processing and producing and outputting that data.
So as well as doing that thinking, are you out in the community or, you know, students and children coming to you? How do you do that mix between the thinking and the communicating?
Yeah, I like to have a balance because I find if I spend too much time behind a computer screen, it turns me into just a bit of a, I don't know, I just start to get a bit tired from it. Whereas as soon as I have some moments with public engagement, I feel immediately energized as well. So I really like to have a balance because it's very easy for me to spend all the time in the techie side of things, just getting the work done, doing the outputs, whatever it is. And I do love that part of my job, right? I love making things like these images and these experiences of our universe. But as far as the public engagement experiences go, it has been very dependent. First, of course, the pandemic definitely knocked things for a loop, and that sent things very virtual, very digital for a long time, which is great because it pushed things into uncomfortable places, right? When we felt we could no longer do things the way we were used to doing them, it actually caused us to be very creative and to try new things. And that led to sonification and other projects as well. But these days, you know, it's starting to become a little bit more normal to have more large public events again, and things feel like a bit like they did previously. And so we've tried to combine the best of what we did before with the best of what we know now to make, you know, any public event that we do has elements of accessibility woven throughout it. No matter who, it doesn't matter who's coming. We never know who's coming to public events necessarily. So I quite literally never leave my house without a 3D print of an exploded star in a bag. Because I know no matter who I come across, whether it's just in a conversation, I can pull it out as a way to discuss something. Or if I'm at an event and there's a young child who wants to touch something, kids like to handle things. I don't blame them. It's fun. Having 3D prints that are meant to be held has helped tremendously in those types of public events. Or if somebody comes by who is blind or low vision or neurodivergent, whatever it might be, I know I'm going to feel prepared in some way, right? You know, I've handed off a lot of the day-to-day operations to some fantastic folks on my team that now do a lot of that public engagement work that I do enjoy, but have a little less time for. But I found that if I don't pencil some of those dates into my calendar as well to kind of get into those public engagement settings, I get too cranky about it. So I have to have some human face time and, you know, public events to kind of get me excited about what I get to do every day. It's a wonderful thing when you're at an event or a lecture or a book signing, whatever it is, whatever it might be, and you get a question from like an 8-year-old child or a 90-year-old great grandparent. It doesn't matter. Like, you're getting a question from someone and they will ask something that I have never considered before. And I love that, right? I love the perspective that those questions will bring. Yeah. I tend to give long answers. I hope that's okay for your podcast.
No, we like long answers. Really interesting. So clearly you love all that. You love the interaction with people and the visualizing of what you do. What are the hard things? What's the challenge of your job?
Oh, yeah. The challenge is definitely stuff I never thought I would be doing. The managing, the budgeting, the politicking, if you will, right? Understanding how government funding works and those types of issues are challenging for me in a way I never really expected. It's something that I'm pushing myself to learn more and more about and to hopefully succeed, whatever success might look like. But those types of things that have settled into my career at this, I don't know, mid-career stage, whatever it is, it is surprising how much energy they take and how much of a learning curve. I feel like I'm having to learn all over again. Like I need to go back to school now again.
So maybe what would be next, an MBA or something, it sounds like.
Right. Or political science. I'm not sure. Maybe both. But yeah, exactly. Exactly. Not what I expected to need to learn. But yeah, I do like learning. So there we go.
So what are you actually working on now, Kim? Is there any specific project you're working on?
A few projects, yes, actually. So we are working on one new extended reality project where we are essentially telling the story of the life of stars through different kinds of 3D modality, either extended reality in like a mixed reality form or a virtual reality form, and sort of taking you through a dead star, for example, in its many versions of information. So whether it is just the 3D model that you get to explore and turn on the iron, the silicon, the sulfur, the calcium, whatever, or listen to the sonification or learn more about it. So we're working on a project right now on that, which I'm very excited about with my fantastic team members. But we've also just celebrated 25 years of the Chandra X-ray Observatory, which is an incredible milestone because Chandra reached its orbit 25 years ago and has been operating beautifully ever since because we essentially talk to it by coding, right? And so all the lovely people here on the ground have been able to keep up the health and safety of a spacecraft that goes about a third of the way to the moon at its farthest point, just through coding and a lot of ingenuity and creativity. And that high resolution, beautiful data of our X-ray universe is wonderful and exciting. And, you know, it has shown us some glimpses of stars that have turned themselves inside out when they explode, and some of the earliest black holes that we've yet discovered, and just everything in between. And so celebrating 25 years has been about a year in the making, and I could go on a little vacation at this point to take a little time off from the universe. But I'm very, very proud of what the Chandra X-ray Center as a whole has achieved in celebrating 25 years. It's no small thing to keep a little, you know, school bus sized object that goes all the way, you know, a third of the way to the moon in such great shape in that cold, harsh environment that is beyond our atmosphere. And to do it all with a bunch of coding and a lot of, you know, know-how and ingenuity is pretty impressive. So yeah, that's kind of where I've settled. And I also did have a new book come out recently too, a new edition of a book. So it's been a busy year.
It sounds like it. It sounds very busy. What about the future? Have you got plans or ideas or thoughts about where you could go with, you know, Chandra or anything like that?
I honestly haven't thought as much about the future as I usually do. And I'm not sure why. Maybe because I've been a bit dragged down to the earth, so to speak. When I was a kid, I used to have my head up in the clouds quite a lot. And I was always a bit of a dreamer, but I feel like the past year or so, the realities of the daily work and some of the challenges with everything has been keeping me a bit more tethered than I usually am. So I think I need to snip that cord and go out into the clouds for a bit and see what's the daydreaming of my future, because I'm just not sure right now. You know, at some point, the mission that I work on will end. And so it will be a very natural segue point to move somewhere else. But what that looks like, I don't know. I have a very slight secret desire to change fields completely and to go into like environmental science and climate change. But, you know, at my age, I feel like that would be a huge risk because I'd have to learn so much more and give up such a big body of knowledge that I've been accumulating over 25 years in astronomy. So yeah, I don't know. I really have to, like I said, cut my cord and allow myself a little bit of time to just breathe and dream.
Yeah, and nice to have that anniversary to celebrate all you've done. I mean, you know, and all that's been achieved. That's always a good feeling.
Exactly. It does feel like a good moment to bask in it, but also give a little space to think what might lie ahead. Not quite sure yet.
Well, that's fantastic. Thank you. So interesting. So much to think about. Yeah, you've had a wonderful career so far, still obviously going strong.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thanks so much for talking to us, Kim. Really, really enjoy it.
Oh, it was my pleasure. I hope somebody else learned something interesting. And yeah, it was great being on the show with you.
Thank you. This podcast is part of the University of Otago alumni series presented by Margie Clark and produced by Fiona McDonald from the Development and Alumni Office of the University of Otago.